Welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Calabrese, a go-to-market strategist with 17 years in food and beverage CPG. I started as a founder, went on to lead venture and private equity-backed startups, and 2 years ago, I launched It's All Happening, an agency that helps early-stage founders get to market faster, smarter, and without burning time and money. Every week, I sit down with the women you need to know in food and bev, and we unpack exactly how they built their brands, how they got to market, the challenges they hit, and the lessons they learned out in the field. So if you're launching a brand or just love hearing how it's really done, you're in the right place. Okay, you guys, I just hung up with Veronica Rivera, founder of Sabe, a new-to-market single-serve sauce/dressing brand. I am just in love with Veronica, and I love her brand so much. She's a Miami native who just moved back home after earning her MBA from the Wharton School of Business. Can we say impressive, right? She was raised in a Latin household where dinner together was really just everything. She launched her brand, Sabe, to bring that flavor and quality into busy everyday life. I love chatting with Veronica. She has such a smart, unique perspective because she is like a badass. She is just very dialed into what is going to turn the dial in her business. So today in our conversation, we talk all about how she first identified a gap in the market, why she wanted to get into single-serve salad dressings, and then how she's been building and taking the product to market. She's had to figure out a lot herself. So this is such a great conversation for all of the founders out there that are bootstrapping and really trying to figure things out. Veronica has learned a lot of lessons and she shares a lot of that. So without further ado, my interview with Veronica Rivera. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Calabrese. Today, I'm here with Veronica Rivera, who is the founder of Sabe, a clean ingredient single-serve sauce and dressing that is brand new to market. Veronica, thank you so much for being here with me today. I'm so excited to chat about your background and your brand.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes, of course. You and I met a while back. We did some like pricing session and profit planning together. And you really stood out to me as a woman on a mission who knows what she wants with her brand. You have such an impressive background. And I just got done telling you how much I love all of your like MBA content that you're pushing out. But Veronica, tell us about what you have been doing and like what life was like before you started this business.
I had the idea for Sabe over 2.5 years ago. And over the last 2 years, I've been doing my MBA. I recently graduated. And before then, I was a management consultant, which meant that I was traveling every single week for work. I was traveling to Atlanta, to New York, and sometimes literally the middle of nowhere where all you could find that was like healthy and reasonable sometimes is those Caesar salads that come prepackaged with like a nasty gloop of dressing on top. Ugh. And I just found my, no, exactly. Ugh. You go to the bodega fridge and you're like, this is it. The option is either this nasty little salad or a protein bar and pretzels. And then you just end up hangry either way. And then when I wasn't traveling, I was still going to the office and I was meal prepping and it was just always the same battle. It was like, you're almost there, 80% the way there to have a perfectly healthy meal. And then you're like, wait, it doesn't even taste good without a sauce. So I think the two ideas kind of just like, or like the two pain points really just stuck with me every single day, regardless of if I was home or traveling. And I was like, there's no product out there that does this, a single serving dressing or sauce that's made with the same ingredients that you'd make with the stuff that you have at home. And something that also isn't a calorie bomb, because nobody talks about that when it comes to dressing. Right. And I was like, you know what? Let me roll up my sleeves and do it myself. And the idea, again, I had the idea over 2 years ago now, and I started my MBA exactly 2 years ago, August 2024. And from there, I was like, you know what? I'm going to give myself these 2 years to really explore, have fun, but also hold myself accountable to this idea that I know could do well and I know that other people resonate with.
Yeah. I just had a random thought though. When you got your MBA, you stopped working. Is that right?
Yes. I did a full-time program. The program was full-time. I had a full class load and it was lots of events going on. And I always said that one of the biggest things that the MBA taught me was to kind of just like put my blinders up and not compare myself into what other people are doing. Because imagine like top MBA program or really an MBA program anywhere. People are like likely to be like type A, really, really impressive backgrounds. People are working on all sorts of different things. There's so many opportunities that you could be chasing while you're at your MBA. And you could really easily fall into the game of comparing yourself into what other people are doing and what other people are prioritizing. So that's one of the skills that I loved that kind of like came to the surface while doing my MBA, because it's the same thing as being a founder in CPG, because it becomes very social forward and very not flashy, but like you have to be on and you have to be engaging online, and you could easily like be super proud of a post that you just did. Maybe it doesn't do numbers, but you refresh your screen and the darling, the unicorn, it has just posted at the same time you did. And you could either take that as a moment to be, and trust me, this happens to me all the time. You could take that as a moment of being like, oh my God, like they're so much further ahead of me. They have so many more followers. They get so many more likes. But then at the same time, you're like, I don't know. I am proud of the stuff that I'm doing. I have to just focus on the here and now.
What program did you do? What school did you go to?
I went to Wharton and I did my MBA, which is a master's of business administration. I was always one of those people that I loved being a student, but undergrad, I was very like obsessive over grades, GPA, like you could fall into that. And doing your MBA, I don't know, I felt like a little freer to take classes that I wanted without focusing too much more on my grades and just maybe deprioritizing a class to focus more on like the resources, because I was obsessed with using all the resources at school. And I think that's how like I maximized my time there. I was using everything that I could. I applied to every single award that I could. I like squeezed as much as I could out of that MBA program.
Yeah, that's what you do. So, okay, in the program, did you find that there was like lots of other people that were also building other businesses? But was that a common theme?
Yes. One of my majors actually is entrepreneurship, but a lot of people do go to the MBA either having done something before or with an idea. But I will say that like just like any, just like life, it could go by really fast. And if you really aren't intentional and like very focused about doing it here and now, it could get away from you. So like casually, there's the term called wantrepreneur that people threw around a lot at school, because people would take like an entrepreneurship 101 and you've got so many ideas. But like that's the first hurdle is like just being like, okay, I'm going to be true to myself and true to this idea and just commit time to it, because it does take so much time. But yeah, that it was a nice feeling having other people like around that I could sometimes lean on, ask a question. And I think that you again have to seek out those programs and those groups and those circles, because you're not just kind of just going to like bump into it. So again, just again, trying to maximize the resources and the networks that you have.
Yeah. You brought up such a good point about wantrepreneur. I mean, this is what I do all day, is I talk to founders, right? And I work with a lot of founders one-on-one every day. It's what I do all day. And I meet so many people that have so many ideas, right?
Yeah.
And I would say like one of the biggest challenges that I see, I mean, there's so many different challenges, but like,
of course,
a major one is founder.
It's like the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. Founder ADD. And it's just like being all over the place and not being able to comb through the like average ideas to like really focus on the good idea that's like a super solid plan. And it's just easy to get tripped up in that. And like you could spend years in that like entrepreneur phase. I love that. I'm going to use that now.
I got a good laugh out of it when I first heard about it. But no, to your point, I have like a few reactions. One, I think it's like being a founder, You could probably relate to this too. It's about like ruthlessly prioritizing your day.
Yes.
And like
yes.
nobody's there to tell you like, oh, this is more important than that. That's more important than this. So it's just about like, I don't know, reviewing like the past week and being like, okay, what moved the needle? Where did I spend the most time? How mm-hmm. can I be a little bit better this week? Like that's I think one of the biggest things and just like holding yourself accountable, like having like, instead of like, a feedback session with your boss, you have to do it with yourself.
Totally.
And I think that's just like a like creating time for reflection and review and like, I don't know, holding yourself accountable. And then I guess yeah. the other point to that is I feel like the MBA was such like a beautiful breeding ground for a business because I had a live audience of people who I could get data from. And I will say that like my brand is heavily, heavily informed and like data driven with like a lot of decisions mm-hmm. and a lot of the changes that we're making. Like I don't like to do anything off of a whim and I'm very okay with changing. Like if I had a hypothesis, an assumption going into it, I'm very okay changing it and when I feel like there's enough data behind it. So to your point, founder ADHD, like one of the first and best things that you could do when you're starting your brand is to get feedback and like to see how people react to it and see what the first thing people talk about when they interact with your brand or your idea is and kind of use that as the first breadcrumb.
Yeah, that's such great advice. I love that. So let's rewind just a little bit because you started the MBA around the same time you started building the business.
Yes.
What is it about the sauce and dressing category that got you interested, separate from the fact that like it was a personal need of yours? You probably looked at some data.
I did look at some data, but I would say that it's more of just like being a person that eats a salad every single day. You go to the dressing aisle in the grocery store and you don't really trust a lot of those brands. And like you ask, like, I don't know, your almond mom or like your aunt that's like super woo-woo and healthy, like, oh, you're always eating healthy. Like, what do you do? They're like, oh, I just make it myself. So for me, it's like, okay, why is there not enough trust with the stuff that's store-bought when everything else they're buying from the store, you know? And you turn over the ingredients and it's right there. It's like the first ingredient usually is like some sketchy oil or like some water that like, yep. and then you keep reading and there's always added sugars, cane sugar, this other, or it's like a stevia of sorts. And mm-hmm. I think like when you think of what a salad dressing or a sauce really is supposed to be, it's supposed to be like that little topping that's like not supposed to make your meal go from like 300, 400 calories to like 1,000, you know, and you can lose yourself and you could lose yourself in the sauce, get lost in the sauce, quite literally.
yeah.
But
totally.
I think it just came from like, just exactly that. Like, cause there's definitely always like an art and science to like starting a business. It's the science is like making sure you do the competitor analysis, making sure you see the data. And like, obviously the better for you trends are just like exploding and like the condiment and sauce space have just, I don't know. People are very open to trying new things in that category, but you start to unpack that and really like see the small kernels of information you get from people who you think could be potential customers, and that's where you start feeling out the reasons to believe even more so.
Yeah, yeah. So, let's start with what you actually did to get the brand going. So, you start business school, you make a decision, I'm going to go all in on dressing, and you choose this format, which is a unique format. There's not a lot of brands out there doing it. We're really used to the 16-ounce glass or plastic bottle in this category. You start looking at that. Like, what did you do first?
The first thing was I got into a kitchen and I started playing around with formulas. And I started to get people to try it as soon as possible because I knew that if I was going to put out a brand in this day and age when there's so much, like it had to be delicious and it had to be something that people actually craved. So if I didn't have a formula, like it wasn't going to go that way. So I developed all my formulas, like the first iteration of them myself, which took a ton of trial and error. And some people, it really depends on what the product category is. So like, I would never give this advice blindly to every single founder, but like, I don't know, I think there's something special about me personally vetting every single one of our flavors and making sure it's up to like what I would put into my body and what I would feel comfortable eating every single day before handing it off to like, I don't know, other people to make sure it's like stable enough to scale. Because that's a whole other side of the coin. The benchtop formula versus the formula that actually gets used in kitchens. And that was a huge learning lesson to me. But I think first things first is get your product and start getting feedback and really listen to what people like about it and what they don't like about it.
Having the founder do the first iterations of the formulation, recipe testing, and like you knowing your ingredients in your product always turns out to be so much more successful, because I work with people in this phase. Like, this is when I partner up with founders, is like right when they start, at the very beginning, when they start the formulation. And the ones who do it in their own kitchen first and develop the flavor profiles and like spec out the ingredients and then pass it off to somebody like a food scientist or the manufacturer to help commercialize it, right, are always so much more successful and have such stronger outcomes than ones who don't necessarily test on their own.
There's always going to be some aid or like somebody, like whether it's a co-man or somebody else, that kind of tries to cut corners sometimes.
Always.
And tries to make it like a little bit even simpler, or like, I don't know, swap out this for the cheaper thing. So like, if you aren't kind of steadfast in your belief behind your formula, like why you need this specific ingredient versus this other one, like nobody is going to care as much as you. So I think it kind of comes down to like obsessing over each detail, mm-hmm, and understanding, like, I don't know, my brand, I feel like we're very intentional about every single thing we put into the formula, and like nothing's there like just for funsies or like, I don't know.
Yeah, no fillers. I personally appreciate that so much as somebody who like, and I love your ingredients because it really is super clean.
Thank you. My favorite thing is when people are like, oh, but let me look at the ingredients. I'm like, yeah, read them.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
Take another look.
There's nothing to hide. And I make all my sauces and I do buy some stuff, but like the majority, I make all my dressings. And yours.
That's how I grew up. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And yours is super clean and just like very trustworthy. On top of it, it's really cute as well, too. The branding.
Thank
great.
You. So. I grew up like I'm not kidding. Every single night for dinner, my dad would make a vinaigrette like on the table. Like he had this little caddy with like oil, vinegar, salt, pepper, and then would like add some stuff. Like every single night, would put it on tomatoes, cucumbers, this, that, the other. Sometimes would just like put it all over his rice. So I kind of just like grew up having like a little fresh sauce next to me. So imagine like when I start working and I start traveling all the time, I'm like, where is this fresh tasting sauce? Mm-hmm. And then
simple.
Yeah. And then the kicker is that my parents are obsessed with like vinegary flavors. So then when I started to buy salad dressings when I was like in college, I'm like, why is it that they're like so much more heavy on the oil side than the vinegar side? So one of the things that I love about our formulas and like why I have to stand up for them all the time is that they are more skewed towards that like fresh, like citrus, like citrus juice or like vinegar. Yeah, they're like for the people who like tangy things. Like if you like a pickled onion, you'd be obsessed with Sabe. Like I always kind of compare that. Or like if you like hot sauces, like I know you're going to love our spicy chipotle, but we like to keep it fresh.
Yes, yes, for sure. That comes out so much. So kitchen formulation, feedback, finalizing flavors, right? Mm-hmm. Now what? Where'd you go? What'd you do?
I think I spent a lot of time in that kind of loop getting feedback and perfecting the formulas. And I think in hindsight, it's always easier to judge what I did and didn't do. But like, I knew that I had to make a decision whether to go with a co-man or to start trying to do it myself. And I think I kind of jumped the gun on that decision and tried to leap into just doing or finding a co-man without really understanding like the like equipment and the processes that were required for my specific product. And I think it goes back to like the same thing about like being the one who formulates your product first. Like, I think you really have to get familiar with how your product is made on a repeatable, scalable way before you go to a co-man sometimes. Like, whether it's like, you know, the formula, you know, the equipment. So like mine's obviously very specific because sauce and dressing that then needs to get put into very specific pouch shape. So it created like a lot of complexity. And I think I was like a little bit too eager to go co-man first. That ended up delaying me a lot. Like I delayed my product launch like quite a bit. I wish, like, sure, I could have wished that I launched earlier. I think I learned a lot of lessons in like the time that like I was bouncing between different co-mans trying to figure out who could actually make it. And then time wasted, but also lots of lessons learned. So I think like in hindsight, find your formulas. Decide whether you think you could like plug and play into a turnkey or like plug and play into an existing solution at a co-man, or roll up your sleeves and start doing it yourself for like the first couple of batches. I think that's probably a better way to go because you'll be able to test demand at a little bit of a larger scale. You'll be able to get really familiar with how the products is made, like what kinks come out when you start packaging it. And you also stay pretty lean. And I think the point on demand is not to be missed because, sure, people could love your product as a sample too, but they also have to love it as a paying customer. And I think that's where, like, if you go straight to a co-man, you could not bury yourself financially, but you know those costs start to add up immediately. So if you kind of start trying to figure out how to make it, like what equipment is required, what types of licensing is required first on your own, I think you might be a little bit better off.
Hey guys, so if you follow me on socials or you listen to this podcast, you definitely heard me talk about Launch Lab. We have a new Launch Lab cohort that's opening up and kicks off on September 14th of this year, 2026. It is my 10-week founder cohort program where I take you through the entire process of what it's like to launch a food and beverage brand. I have created a framework that is tried and true that I've used before with hundreds of brands to get them launched successfully, strategically, without wasting time and money. If you are new to this, you're new to the industry, and you're really not sure where to start, this program is for you. Think of it as a way to protect your investment and really just ensure that you do things the right way. Registration opens up September 1st. If you sign up for the wait list, you will have access to a really significant bonus that will be available only to the waitlist members that is going to open up a day before registration opens. If you have any interest in starting your brand or you're in research mode and you really just need some guidance, highly recommend Launch Lab. Check out all the testimonials and reviews on my Instagram and on my website. I've helped so many people do this the right way. So sign up for that waitlist. The link is in the show notes and keep an eye out for the registration when it opens on September 1st. As soon as the slots fill up, that's when the registration closes and we kick off on September 14th. So because you're a single serve sachet, there's just not a ton of people out there who fill this type of product.
No, it was basically just like cold calling like all day long for like weeks at a time. And I think, to my earlier point, like no one's going to care as much as you. Like there were so many times during that summer when I was like being a maniac cold calling people that like sometimes it would take so many times to get a co-man on the phone to talk to a little tiny fish like you when they have such larger clients. So I think that's where like, again, like being resilient comes into play and like where you need a resilient bone in your body as a founder because it takes a lot of hustle. And sure, like I could probably also like in retrospect say that like, okay, if they're not answering you so much, that's also a red flag, which is something that happened to me. Lessons learned along the way. But there's also, you're also going to have to face the music that like, they're not going to actively seek out your business either when they don't know you. You don't have any proven track record. You probably don't have a lot of capital to be throwing around either. So you kind of have to be on top of them.
Okay, so you started with a co-man, but then did you like quickly realize that it just wasn't going to work? Or like,
it was not quick. It was like slow and painful. I think I like tried to fit the mold with this one co-man, and this happened to me like, I guess, three times, three separate co-mans. That like, and that's why I say like it took me a long time to figure this out. And like, sure, I could go back and think like, oh my God, it took me so much time. I should have gotten it sooner. But I also give myself grace because I was a full-time student and like had a whole other life. Well, I had life to live, or like I was a student. I had a bunch of stuff going on in the daytime. Yeah. So lessons learned. But yeah, three times. And the issues with each of them were all separate. But like a lot of it came down to like just bad communication between the owners and like myself. And then sometimes lack of expertise, and then lack of trust, because they would swap out things in my formula. I'm like, this is a completely different color. There's no way you're using the same ingredients that I'm using. And then some other times it would be like some sanitary issues that when I did a site visit, I was like, oh my gosh, like,
this place is not up to standards.
This place is not for me. So like in retrospect, make sure they're giving you time of day, like whether it's once a week or once every other week, but like that you could reliably get on the phone with them and do a site visit. Always do a site visit if you're going to go with the co-man, because there was one of the co-mans that I was working with, like he was very against me coming to do the site visit. And I was like, that should have been a red flag from day one, but it took me a lot longer to figure that out. But now you know, lessons learned.
Yeah. So, all right. So you're going back and forth on manufacturing. You've gone through a couple of co-mans. At what point did you say, you know what, F it, I'm going to do it on my own?
Yeah, I think it was like earlier this year, after like one of the failed relationships. I was just like, I had grown a little bit of a following online, and I had kept saying like, I'm going to launch now. And then I like, in the beginning of 2026, I had said like, we're launching early 2026. And the last co-man, I guess the one that broke the camel's back, kind of like, I was like, I need to pull out of this relationship and just like take matters into my own hands and just figure out how I'm going to do it. And yeah, I think it was also that I was owing it to like people that really wanted to try the product and had been following along for so long and had seen the journey and were just eager to try it, that I was like, let me do this. I could do this. I could figure it out. And this won't be a forever step, but it'll be the first step. And I'm going to learn a lot along the way.
So what did you do to get your own manufacturing situation set up?
So I worked with these food scientists that usually do a lot more formulation, but they helped me develop like almost like a little plan to figure out how you could do this on your own without a co-man. And I think that like I was more so scared in the sense that I was like, oh my God, I don't have this background. I don't have like, this is like, I'm a business student. Like I was a consultant. Like I'm good at like the stuff on an Excel sheet, on a PowerPoint, but like
very different than being in a kitchen.
Yeah. Like rolling up your sleeves and getting in there. But I think like, I don't know, it's the same thing with any class. Like you do the reps, you study what you're supposed to do. Like I have like certifications now in like XYZ food scientists and like, and acid foods and all this different stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just giving yourself the time to learn how to actually do it, and a lot of time to like fail, but like also giving yourself the flexibility to hire other people that know what they're doing. Like,
yes.
For instance, like when we worked together, I didn't know what I was doing in that specific domain. So it's like looking yourself in the mirror and saying like, okay, I'm good at this. I know I could upskill, but it's going to take me so long that like maybe it's worth bringing in an expert to help me just set it up and get the foundation going.
Yeah, at 100%. I'm like a firm believer, and like, you have to bring in people in the areas that you're just not an expert in. And you don't need to be an expert in everything. You just don't. It's not possible, right? And it's okay during this process, this like startup phase, to say, I need some help here, you know?
Yeah.
So, okay, cool. So you hire this group.
Yeah. I basically worked with them at their facility. It was like a shared facility. They kind of like took the lead and showed me what to do. from more like a safety and like a quality standpoint. And when I tell you, these guys have like the gold standard for safety and quality that like it made me so happy to go through that process with them, because it's now kind of defined how I'm going to run my organization for the rest of its life. Sure, like I said before, product comes first, but to me, quality and safety come even before that, because if it's not safe, but it tastes good, I'm like, I'm not even going to serve that. Get out of here. No way.
Yeah.
I loved working with them because their first thing was safety, and they were just so rigorous about how they did it. But now since graduating, we've moved it down here to Miami, Florida, which is where I'm from, where my team is mostly based out of. And I think we did that for primarily like to have a tighter sense of control over the product, because if I'm making the product somewhere in the middle of the US, like I either have to be there or I have to have total trust in the team making it. And I think at this stage, like I'd rather just own it all myself while we're still growing and still validating demand and working out the kinks and iterating our product and iterating our packaging. So yeah, we're doing it down here in Florida, and I couldn't be happier about the stage that we're at right now.
Okay, so cool. I love this. I love that like you really explored the co-man thing and just realized that it just wasn't for you at this phase and decided to take matters into your own hands. And I think it's very smart that you hired people to help with just like the whole process.
Even now, like I have people helping me with like different licensings and all the little details that like you could, I don't know, lose track of. And
yeah,
I'm the first person that I'm like, okay, I know what I'm good at. I know what I'm not good at. Like I could learn anything, but you have to be realistic about the amount of time that it's going to take you to learn. So it's just a trade-off, I think.
Now, you know, you're live, you're selling on your website. What has the feedback been with the product, and like, what are people saying about it?
I think a lot of people, when I demo, they're like, oh my God, this idea, I wish I had this idea. Like it's just so in front of your face that you're like, wow, like it's like a relatable product. Everybody has been there where they're like, oh my gosh, I want a meal prep. Oh my gosh, I want to take this lunch to work, but like, it's not going to taste good without a sauce. But I think people are really loving our flavors. It surprises me every single time we demo, like which way people go. And on like certain days, maybe like our lemon mustard dressing is really popular, but lately our miso tahini has been super popular at demos. But an interesting thing, I don't know, I find it quite interesting is that at demos, people try the miso tahini first always, but the one that sells the best individually is the lemon mustard. And then in stores, I think it's a mixed bag, but our OG sampler that comes with all three of each of our flavors, that one by far does the best. So it was really like, it was a fun exercise in the beginning to figure out how much inventory I was going to allocate to the sampler boxes versus the own boxes. And I think like being a first-time founder, not having all the money in the world to have like a demand forecasting team, like I thought that was like a fun and interesting exercise, and you learn a lot along the way. But it's been interesting to see like how much product we need for each of them and how much we have to build and you know, all that stuff.
So based on the feedback that you've gotten, have you had to make any packaging changes, or did you like nail the packaging from day one? I always love to chat with people about that, because like I always have this conversation with founders, like I pinky promise you that your packaging on day one is going to look different.
Oh, totally.
A few months or like down the road.
Yeah. We're in the process of fixing our packaging a little bit, like two things. And it was also, again, highly informed with data. Like one of my last Wharton classes, we did this massive, it was like a brand strategy class. And you had to do this massive project with like eight people, and you had to get like 50 interviews and like 50 quantitative interviews, and then maybe like 10 interviews in person with people. And we asked, and my team graciously let us do Sabe for the project. So I got like a massive report at the end of the class.
So cool.
Yeah, it was awesome. And it was just like a lot of feedback on like, oh, I wouldn't consider this. I wouldn't know it's clean ingredient just from the front of the brand. And I'm like, front of the package. And I was like, oh my God, mute, like camera turned off. Like, exactly. Yeah, I was like, that's the biggest problem. Yeah. So we're making tweaks to have that like called out, because my first intuition was like, oh, like it's so simple. Like people are going to know that it's like a newer brand that has cleaner ingredients. I'm like, no, people don't know unless you tell them.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
So we're calling that out. And then another thing people love is like the macros on it. And I was very hesitant at first to put the macros on the front of the pouch because I didn't want it to come off as like
a fitness.
Health, food, fitness.
Yep.
Too much being like pushing the calories in your face, because I think when you say something's healthy, I guess like there's two camps, people that think it's low calorie and people that think it's clean ingredient. And I didn't want this to be like almost like an 100 calorie snack, like one of those little products that like have really bad ingredients at the sake of being low calorie.
I didn't want
it to come off in that sense. So we're adding those two call outs, the clean ingredient and the macros, and playing around with some like color and design choices that help increase appetite appeal. Because that was something that we got in the beginning, that they were like, it's very interesting, it's very artistic, very cute, but I don't really know what it's going to taste like when I'm just looking at it. And I was like, that's interesting. Because you see so many packages out there that have like, I don't know, for a lemon, they have like a big lemon blown up on the front of it. And like, for whatever reason, people continue to do that. Because I guess it works, and there is something there. I think it's just the way that you do that could be done in a more thoughtful way. But my first intuition was like, oh, I don't want to have those big like icons. I don't want it to
of the ingredients.
Like, I don't want it to seem like everything else out there. But now I'm like, okay, I guess it's on there because it works for something. So
yeah, getting the packaging to work for you it's a process, right? And it takes real life feedback of real customers and people actually eating it over and over again.
Totally. Like whenever I do big changes, I go to like my super fans. I'm like, I know you are like one of our top customers. Tell me what you think about this packaging. Like, would you be so upset? Would you like it? Whatever.
Yeah.
It's like a challenging investment at first. And I think it's about finding somebody that you trust. Like, I love the designers that I've worked with, like shout out to them.
Can you share who you worked with? Because your branding is just so unique. I love it.
Yes. The designers that I work with have all been referrals through friends. One of them, his name was Ryan. Shout out to Ryan. He helped come up with like our like logo that I feel like is so iconic. And now I'm working with another friend named Paulina that she's kind of helping me translate all the feedback that I've gotten in the last like couple of months since being live, but still keeping that like logo and like that I don't know, the uniqueness,
the personality,
the identity, exactly. Yep. But just translating it in a new way. So I'm excited about the tweaks that we're doing, but I think to my earlier point, there was like a couple brands when I started getting quotes for designers, I would reach out to some of these agencies and be like, hey, I'm starting my own business. I'm bootstrapping. Like all the inklings that like, this is a very small operation and there's not a lot of capital around here. And some of these designers would kind of, I don't know, I guess they have to be true to their prices, but they would quote me these ridiculous things. I'm like, I'd rather you just tell me like off the bat, like we're probably not a fit, before you kind of like stone cold face quote me this ridiculous thing after I've just told you that how I'm really building this from the ground up myself. So I guess it's like finding somebody who, I don't know, that you trust, that they really have your vision, but also don't go and invest in that like $50,000 like brand package.
No.
Or like,
no, no.
Don't go, because to your point, like you don't even know if it's going to resonate. Like you don't even have any like proof points or like validations. And I guess, again, to the beginning point that we talked about, like don't compare yourself to these brands that have like influencer backings, that have like these super deep wallets, that they're working with like the best designers out there. So it's just different phases. Like eventually, like maybe you can work with those designers and do a beautiful refresh. But in the beginning, like keep it smaller, keep it with people that you trust that actually have like really good vision. Don't sink yourself over this before you've tested it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, look, branding is so important. Like we all know that, right?
Super.
Like it's super important. It's got to look cool. It has to be unique.
Especially in this day and age, like you really like, I don't know, if you could tell also if people have like an AI generated logo. And I think it's so crazy that some people do that.
Yeah. I'm like, don't get me started on that.
So there's a balance. I'm like, don't just do it like you yourself on Canva unless you're like an experienced designer, but also just don't go on the deep end and hire like the most expensive thing just because, I don't know, the celebrity brand hired those people too.
Exactly. I have founders that I've worked with before that come with bigger budgets and they want to drop 50, 80K because they like the portfolio. And I just never allow it. I'm just like, absolutely not. Like, it's just, yeah, we're not going to spend that kind of capital at the beginning. You can spend the 50 to 80 to 100 budget on branding is for after you've raised a $5 million, you know, series, yeah, A, series B with a VC firm, and you're like really have some serious goals that you're trying to hit. And like, that's when you engage in like, yeah, the pricier, you know, branding agency, but not until then, you know what, yeah, I mean? Like not until then. We're working with people who are like less agency, more independent contractors. And also like, I've seen some of the best brands come that way anyway.
Oh yeah. No, like the creative stuff that like some of these independent designers do is like I feel like they're just more free, like again. Mm-hmm. So like they just come up with the coolest stuff, like breaking rules and all that type of stuff. So it's been so much fun to work with independent designers.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up. Biggest lessons that you've learned. One piece of advice that you could give to a founder that was coming to you that was just getting started, what would you say to her?
I think it would be to just get started, like dive in, like stop worrying about, oh, if I post, people might judge me. You get over that fear so fast, like start building in public. Even if you're not good at it, you're going to get better. Even if you don't know where to start, just start and like give yourself grace while doing it because it is really hard. It gets sometimes really lonely. It gets really challenging. There's a lot of sacrifices that come with it, but just start. And like, if you feel yourself getting obsessed with it and like, it's all you could think about, and there's like this gravitational pull between you and the idea, like keep chasing it. Like there, like you have to at that point, it becomes something that like, I don't know, you're called to do. That's how I feel. And even on like the hardest days where I have like mini meltdowns, my family and friends can attest to it. Like, there's still something that I'm like, I just have to do this. I have to do this. Like, I believe in it so much that like, there's no other way. Like, yeah, we just have to pick ourselves up and just do it. Keep going.
Yeah, keep going. Keep going. That's such great advice. I love that so much. Veronica, thank you for sharing your story.
Of course. Thank you again for having me on. I don't know. I love just sharing my story about Sabe. There's like, and I don't know, I feel like I built my brand listening to podcasts like this and getting tidbits of advice. So wherever I could be helpful to somebody else, like I'm more than welcome to share.
Oh yeah. There were some gems in here today for sure. So thank you so much. And I can't wait to see where Sabe goes.
Sabe world domination.
I love it. I'll talk to you soon. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. It would mean so much to me if you like, subscribe, or share this episode with anyone who you think needs to hear. And if you're launching a brand and you need a CPG strategy advisor, visit my website to check out what we have to offer. I host free workshops from time to time. You have to sign up for emails to hear about those. And you can join Launch Lab, which is our group cohort that teaches you the four critical phases of launching your CPG brand and how to actually execute your launch quickly. We also do one-on-one advising. So if you book a profit plan session, I will assess your product profitability and recommend a package that works for you. You can book a call at itsallhappeningagency.co. You can email us at hi@itsallhappeningagency.co and follow us on Instagram at itsallhappeningco. See you soon.